You want to come a little closer so you can really see it. Okay, I'm very happy to see you all here tonight to hear what I think about this work of art, even if only for 20 minutes. So I'm going to ask and answer three questions. What are we looking at? Why the portrait bust? And why did I pick this piece to talk about out of all the works in the museum that are on display right now? Okay, I'm going to step over here so you can see them. Come on. These two busts, dating from almost two decades ago, 1993, are self-portraits of the artist, Jeanine Antoni, and they aren't chiseled for marble, on the one hand, or modeled in dark, unglazed clay. They're actually cast from the same mold. The piece's title, Lick and Lather, is the clue to the materials they're actually made out of. Chocolate on the left and soap on the right. Antoni probably had some assistance in making the mold, but she isn't the kind of artist who has her work made by outside contractors or fabricators or even a bevy of assistants. She even made the soap that was cast into the mold herself out of lye and lard. Remember that for future reference. In the traditional soap recipe, the chocolate, which was ordered through the mail from a Wisconsin candy maker, is kind of the cheapest kind of chocolate because apparently good chocolate does not hold up well, and it's very delicate and ephemeral. This is the kind, you know, think Easter bunnies from the discount store. You forget it in a secret hiding place in your room as a child. You find it 10 years later, and it tastes exactly the same. It's that kind of chocolate. And you can see what's happening as it ages. It gets a bloom on the surface, which looks like a patina. It's really beautiful. It looks like it's bronze. In the original installation to which these belonged, I'm going to pass these around from this direction and this direction, there were seven each. A line of seven soap busts and a line of seven chocolate busts facing each other. And all of them were united again, one more time in 1993, and probably if Jeanine Antoni has a major retrospective, maybe they'll all be gathered together one more time, but they have been dispersed to collections, public and private, in the form of these two busts. As far as I know, there's never just one, but always the two. I've been wondering if she specifies chocolate on the left and soap on the right. But, okay, I want you to look closely. Don't get too close or the guard will get irritated. But you can really look at the difference between the hair on the soap bust and the hair on the chocolate bust. That seems to be the place where it's most clear. They have this worn down, almost weathered quality. And this is because casting them was only the first step in Antoni's process. She then shaped them. She got into the bathtub with the soap busts and gently, very delicately and lovingly washed them for up to 5 hours in the tub with the bust. If you look at that picture that's going around, there's the one, the soap bust that's in the front appears to have quite a substantial amount of the top of its head washed away. Here there's no hair texture left and it's all smooth. So that's the lather. The chocolate ones were licked. The artist herself licked them, adjusting them in various ways. It's harder to see on this, but the right eye, as we're facing it, has been effaced and the shape of it is gone more than the left eye. And there's some texture gone in the hair in various places. Each one was handled or licked in a slightly different way in a process that I would think of as literally defacing them. So here's how she described the genesis of this piece in an interview. I wanted to work with the tradition of self-portraiture, but also with the classical bust. I had the idea that I would make a replica of myself in chocolate and in soap, and I would feed myself with myself and wash myself with myself. Both the licking and the bathing are quite gentle and loving acts, but what's interesting is that I'm slowly erasing myself through the process. So for me, it's about that conflict, that love-hate relationship we have with our physical appearance, and the problem I have with looking in the mirror and thinking, is that who I am? Other early pieces by Antoni had the same feminist shudder of recognition of self-loathing, bulimia, anorexia, adjusting appearance to suit societal norms. There were a number of younger women artists in the 90s who dealt with cosmetics, you know, with the idea of body image. It's a theme in feminist art, but this particular version of it, to me, in 1990, one of the good examples of this is her painting the floor of a gallery using her own long hair and multiple bottles of Clairol Loving Care hair color until the entire floor of the gallery was covered with these expressionistic strokes using her hair as her brush. When she made the piece you see here, she'd already experimented with lard and chocolate. A piece called Gnaw, that is G-N-A-W, consists of two 600-pound blocks, one of lard and the other of chocolate, carved essentially with the artist's teeth. She worked at them with her teeth, spitting out what she bit off, and those spit-out parts were also reconstituted into a further addition. She also placed herself in a bathtub and had liquefied lard poured around her in a sideways position, and then as it cooled and hardened, extricated herself. And the piece was about kind of the absence of Antoni. That makes me think of those empty shells that were left behind when burning hot volcanic ash fell on people in Pompeii, you know, the ones they discovered where there's nothing inside but just the shell. Not to mention the work of artist Anna Mendieta, who created impressions of herself and recorded them. Were both of these things part of Antoni's inspiration? Who knows? This is what critics and art historians do. Present these connections, happy to be able to connect the dots. And I'm doing that right now for you. But I also want you to think about Antoni's acts as not just borrowing. It's a journey towards finding a vehicle for an idea, a feeling, an emotion, a zeitgeist. She takes everyday activities like sleeping, eating, or washing and makes them into sculptural processes. The resulting thing isn't the endpoint. You could describe these processes as thinking with the body, conceptual art through the body itself. It's performative and ritualistic. It calls up myths and dreams. Like a lot of young artists in the 80s and 90s, including me, Antoni's exposure to the ideas and works of Joseph Beuys, god of conceptualism, were really important. His signature materials were fat, of course, and felt. Antoni may also have heard about or seen the work of Dieter Rothe, who was a Swiss Fluxus artist, an amazing, much under-recognized artist. One of his pieces that was more widely known was a bust made of chocolate and birdseed that he placed outside for the birds to pick at. But again, this is all the kind of game that we like to play to explain where things come from. For me, the thing that makes Antoni an artist of her time is her understanding of the work as a performative object. Okay, so here's what I mean by a performative object. In a way, these busts are the residue of a private performance that took place as she washed them, as she licked them. And we can find ourselves imagining it, even though no one has ever seen it. At least I imagine myself when I look at this, licking one of these busts or holding one in the bathtub. And that's actually, Antoni describes this kind of physical understanding of her act as understanding the work through your body. She also thinks, and I agree, that not seeing her do it, but rather imagining the event, is much more potent and powerful than any kind of documentation of it would be. Okay, so this was made, this full piece, the one with the two rows, for her debut in the Venice Biennale, 1993. I mean, she'd been invited to be in it. This was the piece she chose to make for it. Another emerging artist from America featured in that Biennale. Anybody know who else was the other star? Matthew Barney. But he didn't win a MacArthur grant. She did. She describes thinking about how these busts would look in Venice, which, you know, living museum filled with classical architecture. But kind of jokingly, she also remarked, I didn't realize that so much of what I saw in Venice would be worn down in the same way that my pieces were worn down. And it's kind of funny. I like that. So why the portrait bust? It's a form preponderantly identified with male figures, nobility, whether religious or secular, political figures, and heroes. Sometimes those categories overlap, but not always. In any case, I think I can safely say it isn't a form we immediately identify with cutting-edge contemporary art. Still, like pretty much everything else from cave painting to the present, the form of the bust became fair game over the 20th century when we decided that context was no longer important, that the past was, we could freely borrow whatever we wanted from the past. So we get that. We're all postmodernists here. In an interview, Antoni mentions looking at 19th century neoclassical busts. But that kind of object holds a whole history of its own within it, not just Roman classical busts, which is the first place from 2,000 or so years ago, but 18th century works by artists like Houdon, who not only did lots of French stars of various kinds, but George Washington and Benjamin Franklin. And Bernini, two centuries before, the whole Baroque tradition of the portrait bust. The point is that the bust turned out to be a useful form for Antoni's ideas, a vehicle. But is it really just that? Aren't these poetic objects something out of a story about the dark sister and the light sister? They tickle that part of the imagination that is buried deep in the unconscious. Personally, I'm very interested in portrait busts, and as a consequence of this mild obsession, I experience this piece in a lot of different ways, but the one that might surprise you is that for me, it's very funny. It tells a secret private joke for women artists in particular, a challenge to the whole lineage in art of the myth of the male hand of genius. You know, a man with a chisel or a paintbrush creating a masterpiece, which is either a picture of another equally heroic man or a naked woman who's standing or lying down as the passive model for his great achievement. Antoni not only takes over and transforms this meaning of modeling by modeling for herself, but she also makes a direct cast of her own features, going straight to the near-perfect replica, making modeling as in forming any material completely unnecessary. No chisel required. She then alters these casts in a way that's intimate, labor-intensive, and as she puts it, an act of erasure. She isn't the only one to act on her pieces in this way either. At the Biennale, a teenage German girl walking through with her parents went up to the chocolate heads and bit off the noses of six of them before a guard stopped her. And this happened three other times in other venues. Antoni considered leaving them with the bitten noses, but in the end decided she didn't like them that way and she remade them. What I'm wondering is, where was that guard? What was he thinking of? So why did I choose this piece to talk about? I mean, they offered me anything in the collection, anything I wanted to talk about. But when I saw this little thumbnail as I'm going through all of the images of everything, I realized that it represents a moment in time, the early 90s, but that I wanted to look at it now, nearly 20 years later. I wanted to look at it closely and think about it as something that existed then, but it also exists now. It's not so 90s, as somebody said to me when I said I was going to talk about it. My feelings about it have changed, I admit. I was jealous of her meteoric rise to stardom. I mean, she went from the Biennale to 5 years later, winning the MacArthur Genius Award. But, you know, the thing is, just as you like different writers at different points in your life, or different music, although that seems like something that almost never goes away. You like different artists. I mean, I have touchstones, things that I go back to look at again and again, year after year, when I go to a museum. But I think when I was younger, when these pieces were made and I first saw images of them, I didn't know what I know now. I didn't have the capacity to understand them or appreciate them in the way that I do now. And I'm actually really glad that they're here so that I can continue to revisit them when they're not in the basement as the years go by. Some final thoughts as I look at these. Maybe there are dark and light selves, virtuous soap and sinful chocolate. Or are they unbaked and fully done, day and night, thoughts and dreams, brain and body? These twins that aren't twins can make you think without thinking, as they suggest everything from myths of origin to the dematerialization of art. It's a story that can be told over and over and over again. So does anybody have any other questions? Because right now, I know everything about this piece. And in another month, I won't remember.
So I wasn't familiar with the artist at all, and I looked her up and, you know, Google, and you get the images. And she has one of the most intimate shots where someone is licking
her eyeball.
So it strikes me when I see this chocolate that the eye is taken away. On the right, there is no eye. And I wonder, does it proceed or...
Oh, this is one of the first well-known pieces. That eye piece is from probably the late 90s or maybe even after 2000. The thing is that she has continued to work in a really inventive way with other materials, but it's always about the experience of the body, mostly hers. She did a long piece that traveled for years about sleep. And she had a machine brought into the gallery that measured rapid eye movement during dreams. She put up a cot in the gallery, and she slept in the gallery. And her rapid eye movement the next morning would serve as the pattern for a weaving she did, a long weaving on a loom in the gallery, which supposedly she modified and invented herself, using strips of the nightgown she wore ripped into shreds. So it was a weaving that continued and continued. She talks about how audiences in different places, she said in Switzerland, no one would talk to her. They were all kind of head down because they just, you know, that was not what they expected for the artist to be there in the gallery. And then in the United States, people all wanted to know about the machine. They wanted to know, that was what they wanted to talk to her about. She said the English were really funny because they always told her their dreams. So everyone was different. But that's a real endurance feat. Can you imagine that? Being in the gallery for weeks at a time.
And actually being able to prove that you were dreaming. Because But the intimacy of the eye.
I can't even look at the photograph, frankly. It's strange.
Really?
Does this art fit a category like conceptual or performance art, in your opinion?
You know, she actually did the loving care piece, painting the floor with her hair, as a performance. She tried doing it first as something that was in the form of the documentary, relics, photographs, the bottles of loving care, and it didn't work. So it is performative, but it's, I mean, performance art covers a whole gamut of things. I mean, some performance art has no residue. There's nothing afterwards. It's an event that takes place. I think of the bottles as stand-ins for the figure, so I guess they're about the same thing. But the fact is that I think this is a very brave thing in a way. I mean, she was young and beautiful. I mean, this is not an idealization. She really was in her 20s and a dish, so, you know. But the thing about the casting is that the multiplicity of it, and that was part of what drew me to the piece when I first saw it, that there were these 14 busts, but yet they were all different. They were the same, but they were different. So you should seriously wait till the guard is distracted and then sort of like try to really look. And you can see the places where they've been. My theory is that since so many of the chocolate ones got, the nose got bitten, that she got really tired of licking, because I can't find as much evidence of licking as I can of the washing process. I just can't, it's the licking feels like more of a punishment. And it also, because those are soap and these are chocolate, I can't help but think about that punishment parents would administer of washing your mouth out with soap, but that licking those chocolate busts for hours would be almost worse than having your mouth washed out with soap, which has a finite duration and it's over.
She created these all at one time?
I think she had to make more, you know, as the ones that were defaced, but the piece is done now. It's not like she's going to continue making them. There are seven of each plus one artist's proof, according to the internet. So, when did the museum acquire this? Do you guys know? Oh, that'll tell us.
2007.
But it's essentially someone bought it and gave it to the museum, because it says collection of Carla Emil and Rich Silverstein.
Maybe
co-owned. Oh, co-owned. Well, that would explain why it's going away, maybe. Lots of pieces are fractional gifts, which means that they live here part of the time and they live at the collector's home part of the time, but they're going to end up here in the end. That's a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah. And they don't have to store it while it's
not
out.
They're updating these rotations of selected histories
too. I understand. That would make just, that's a Mendieta piece over there, isn't it? So that's perfect that they're near each other.
What's she doing now?
She's making work. Some of it's really strange, some kind of like a gargoyle she cast so she could urinate outdoors. You have to look at it. Just look at the newest images, but it's still interesting and good. And if all of you are going to the lecture, you probably should go.
Thank you.
You're welcome.